Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Out of the Blue by P. D'Angelico, narrated by Charlotte North. Chapter 1. Nobody prepares for catastrophe. I mean, let's be real. It's not like anyone wakes up one day and says, "Today is the day I get ready for my life to hit a brick wall going 100 miles per hour," and acts accordingly. Because, my two cents here, whether we'd like to admit it or not, most of us hope for the best, even though we often get the worst. Fundamentally, the human species is a tragically optimistic lot. It's what keeps us moving, evolving, thriving. Myself included, even though personal experience has taught me that life doesn't give notice. Good and bad happen, for lack of a better description, out of the blue. In the corner of my left eye, Jess's white BMW 3 Series comes into view. It's traveling toward me at a high rate of speed, blowing with nary a pause past the Harris Ranch sign, which has been hanging at the end of the driveway since this place was built close to 100 years ago. In fact, I'm absolutely certain she just hit the gas. The car fishtails and kicks up a cloud of red dust. It's a scene straight out of a Mad Max movie. Uh-oh. My feelers immediately perk up, because the immutable facts are as follows. Fact number one. Jess works in Beverly Hills as a junior agent at one of the big three talent agencies, a good hour and a half away from the furthest reaches of Ojai, where the Harris Ranch is located. Fact number two. Jess hates anything remotely rural. You'd have to drag her by her perfectly flat-ironed hair to any place that isn't covered in concrete. Fact number three, it's Jess, so this is going to be bad no matter what it is. I have never been great at math, but at this moment, I am Isaac freaking Newton, calculating every variable from wind speed to the ground distance I need to cover to get to the farmhouse. Unfortunately, I determined that even my personal best isn't good enough to save me. In other words, I don't have the time to run and hide, which I could argue is a good general description of my life thus far. Brace for impact, Billy. Billy, the one-eyed dwarf goat we rescued from a neglectful petting zoo, squints at me with his one good yellow eye, but otherwise remains by my side next to the feeder. Little man loves to eat. The problem is, with the heat index hovering somewhere between a convection oven and hot as the deepest corners of hell, the grain mixed with flax seeds sours quickly, and this batch needs to be dumped. All in a day's work when you run a rescue that includes multiple regular-sized horses and two elderly percherons, three mini-horses, two sheep, four goats, two mini-donkeys, one lamb, one llama, and a couple of chickens. No partridge in a pear tree yet. Dropping the shovel on the rain-thirsty summer ground, I tip up my baseball cap and wipe my sweaty face with the collar of my faded Raiders t-shirt, because hunched over a pile of rancid leftover grain isn't how I want to have this conversation. The BMW comes to a hard stop in front of the fence I'm standing behind, and dirt billows up around me. It lands and sticks to every exposed, sweaty surface of my body. Excellent. The car door swings open, and the red sole of my best friend's black Louboutin high heel hits the ground hard. Mierda, she growls. Pushing her black Tom Ford sunglasses to the top of her head, she inspects the dirt covering her pumps with an expression of pure disgust. Hey? My voice comes out strangely high and thin, shooting up on the last vowel like it does when shit's about to get real. What are you doing here? I ask, sliding out between the slats of the paddock fence to face whatever reckoning's coming. In your work clothes. In the middle of the day? To understand the question, you'd have to understand my BFF. Jess is the person who rings your doorbell unannounced at 1 o'clock in the morning, holding an overnight bag because she decided a trip to Vegas is suddenly, absolutely essential. I once went 74 hours without sleep because she insisted on driving to Texas to see a Beyoncé concert. We were 16 at the time. Her parents were not amused that we borrowed their car without permission. Jess is the most spontaneous person I've ever met, And that's saying a lot, because I used to be pretty spontaneous myself. But there's good reason to be on guard whenever she shows up for an unscheduled visit, because there's a very good chance that an arrest warrant awaits you at the end of that journey. Her brown eyes drag from her expensive kicks to me, and for a split second, there's a heavy dose of guilt in them that only a rare few who know her well would detect. If you answered your dang phone, I wouldn't need to be here ruining my new shoes, would I? She's obviously still salty about her shoes, so I tamp down the urge to chuckle at her expense. Who answers calls anymore? Learn to text like the rest of civilized society. I did text, you savage. Maybe check your phone more than once a week. She has me there. I've been enjoying my comfortably numb bubble for the last few years, and any intrusion from the outside world feels like a chore now. Jess's gaze runs up and down my body, her expression pained. You're wearing overalls. The woman is positively militant about fashion. They're practical. She shakes her head. I thought you were going through a phase when you took this job. She glances around. Who lives like this? You mean, who lives in the country, enjoying the fresh air and physical safety? I do. I live like this. And it's a phase I plan on continuing forever. I love Ojai. I love everything about it. More importantly, however, it's been the safe place I desperately needed. Nothing would ever compel me to move back to LA. Not even the food trucks. A donkey's very loud bray cuts the awkward pause in the conversation. Your life is officially an episode of Naked and Afraid. With a 5-star spa resort in town, I counter, compelled to defend my little slice of heaven. More like naked and pampered. It's just so... She rubs her manicured fingers together, testing the grit in the air. Grimy. That fact alone makes her visit all the more suspicious. Are you going to tell me why you're here, or are we going to play truth or dare? Chewing on her bottom lip, her gaze slides over to meet mine. Yeah, we need to talk. Jessica? Nodding, some more nodding, her perfectly airbrushed mask falls, and she suddenly looks nervous. Okay, so I did a thing. My smile dips, all the way down, to my feet. You did a thing? It goes without saying that nobody here assumes it's a good thing. What kind of thing did you do? You know who Aiden Hughes is, right? I can't even pretend to be offended by her question, because celebrities in general and current news about them are not at the top of the list of things I give a flip about these days. The actor? Yeah, the guy's a train wreck. Exactly! The devious spark in her eyes tells my well-developed survival instincts that it's legitimately time to be scared. Anyway, Cruella reps him. No, comes out hard and fast because Cruella is her code name for her evil boss, and I know a trap when I hear one. I haven't asked you anything yet. Whatever it is, the answer is no. Twisted sisters, she says forcefully, if not a little desperately. And shit. Jess and I have been friends since the day her family moved to the San Fernando Valley and into the apartment next door to the one I shared with my dad. I was an only child, hungry for someone to bond with, and Jess was one in practice since her older brother Robert had enlisted in the Marines. We quickly bonded over our general grievances about our parents, my singular one parent being largely absent and her still married parents being overbearing. That and our mutual love of adventure. We made a pact all those years ago to look out for one another. This pact included a safe word, twisted sisters. Were it ever invoked, the other person would have to agree to the request, no questions asked. The one stipulation was that it had to be something important, a life-changing event. You're calling it? I ask, forced to double-check my disbelieving ears. I'm calling it. She glances up into the scorching sun, face pinched, and pulls her shades back down over her eyes. Can we do this inside? My recently lasered skin is hating me right now. Granting mercy, I head for the farmhouse. Follow me in the car, I tell her. The black pencil skirt she's wearing won't allow for more than an inchworm step. It would take her 20 minutes to cover 100 feet from the paddock to the farmhouse, and I'm anxious to get this over with. The main house is everything you'd expect a 100-year-old California farmhouse to look like. The ivory-painted concrete exterior is marred with chips and cracks. The red clay-tiled roof has a number of busted and missing tiles, and the oak wraparound porch has seen better days. There's a lot of wear and tear, but there's also plenty of charm. When I moved in 3 years ago, it was falling apart. Some elbow grease and a lot of help from a talented local handyman have transformed it into something special, a place I'm lucky to call home. On the porch, I kick off my muck boots and push the screen door open. Heading straight to the kitchen, I motion for Jess to follow. One of the largest rooms in the house, it was built big enough to feed all the men working the ranch over the years. Close to 50 at one point. Now, it only feeds 2. I hand Jess a can of Diet Coke from the refrigerator and pull out the pitcher of lemonade for myself. "How's Irma?" I ask. For years, her parents served as my de facto adopted ones, acting more parental than my own at times. With my dad working long hours and late nights as an LAPD detective, I spent many nights eating and sleeping over at the Martinez house. I could go weeks without seeing my dad for more than an hour or two a day. "Good," she says nonchalantly, while an elephant runs rampant in the room. "Your dad?" Shrugging, she looks away and back. A year and a half ago, Juan had a massive heart attack, and although she'd never admit it, not even to me, I know she's been worried about him ever since. Jess has always had a tough shell, an innate ability to let everything roll off her back without allowing it to leave a lasting impression. So this comes as no surprise. But after working in Hollywood for years, that shell had transformed into an impenetrable armor. And I'm fairly certain it's not a good thing. "She's got him on a low-carb, low-fat, no-salt, no-sugar diet, and it's making him bitchy as fuck." "That's tough," I say, wincing in solidarity. "Hold the sympathy." She takes a long drag of her soda. "She found a burrito in a brown paper bag taped to the back of the toilet bowl tank the other day." Pausing, she looks me over, scrutinizing my face. "My mother keeps asking when your bony white ass is coming over for dinner." We've officially hit the third rail of the conversation. There's no easy answer to that. The incident, as I like to call it, changed everything. While on my way home from working a late shift 4 years ago, I was assaulted in the parking lot of our old building. Thankfully, my dad has now moved into a new place down the street. But the Martinezes still live there, just off Victory Boulevard in Van Nuys. Sympathy fills Jess's brown eyes.
"Never mind, I know what you're going to say."
"That I can't. That I'm too busy when it's only partly true. Rationally, I know the man who attacked me can't ever hurt me again, but the experience changed me forever. Fear can't be reasoned with. It's got its own set of rules. And rule number one is you either conquer it or submit to its crippling power. It's taken me 4 years to accept that I'll never be the same again."
"Are you seeing a therapist?"
"I was seeing a therapist when I was living in LA, but after a while, rehashing the past didn't feel productive anymore. It was time to move on and move forward. Starting over somewhere new, without all those memories, felt good, instead of constantly talking about what had been."
"Too busy right now."
The concern on her face makes me uncomfortable, like I'm failing somehow.
"You're gonna have to face those demons sooner or later."
"I'm not entirely sure that's true. First, they've gotten way smaller and more manageable. And second, I'm very comfortable with where they are right now. Out of the way, nicely tucked in the back of my mind, where I tend to them as assiduously as I do the animals in my care, but otherwise don't have to deal with them."
"Thanks, Dr. Drew. I'll work on it."
"Besides, what's wrong with ignoring your issues? Is there a rule that says issues need to be dealt with at all? Do they have rights? Is the ACLU calling for issues representation? Until then, like the saying goes, keep your friends close and your issues closer. Or something like that."
"Hi, y'all," comes from down the hall. Mona waltzes into the kitchen, followed closely by a man who could be Sam Elliott's ugly cousin. How to describe Mona Harris? Mona's a plus-sized 50s pinup girl with black hair and bright blue eyes, fond of tight-fitting shirts and jeans and dirty jokes. She's somewhere around her late 60s. I'm guesstimating because who the heck knows? There's no way Mona would ever admit her true age. She's even blacked out the year on all her IDs with a Sharpie marker. "This is Darby," she says, motioning to the silver ponytailed man, making rude eyes at her body. None of us miss the fact that Mona looks worked over, her hair sticking up in all the wrong places. She'd either run through a car wash or spent the morning riding Darby. My money's on Darby. He's got the glassy look in his eyes to prove it. Mona's bright blue gaze shifts between me and Jess. "What are y'all up to today?" A point of clarification, Mona was born and raised in Southern California. There's absolutely no reason for her to speak with a Southern accent, and yet that obvious fact does not seem to stop her. She falls somewhere between Blanche Devereaux and Rose Nyland on the Golden Girls scale. Weird fake accent and shenanigans aside, she's one of the kindest, most generous people I've ever met. The minute I sat down on her beat-up leather couch for my interview, I knew immediately that I wanted to work for her. I shoot her a look that says, "Why the hell is there a strange man in the house?" This isn't even the first time I've had to use it. "Didn't we discuss not having strange men over without alerting the other person?" I whisper hiss, pointing to myself in case there was any question about who the other person is.
"Darby isn't strange."
She throws a sassy look at a smiling Darby.
"Are you, Darb? I mean, you do like to do that thing with your toes, but that's more kinky than strange."
Jess snorts. Diet Coke shoots down the wrong pipe, and she coughs until I'm forced to lean over and pat her back. A phone rings with an incoming text message, and Darby fishes a cell phone out of the back pocket of his jeans.
"My Uber ride is here. Bye, sugar."
Then I have to suffer through watching him place a chaste kiss on Mona's lips, which she turns into a tonsil hockey session.
"You have Uber out here?"
Jess mutters, genuinely surprised.
"No," Darby clarifies. "It's my son. He does his own thing, driving people around. But it's like an Uber."
Okay, Jess replies, obviously confused. Darby exits, and I glance at the clock on the oven and see it's feeding time for the horses. Now that Mona's kinky lover has departed, can we get to business?
"Wouldn't hurt you to get one too, you know,"
Mona volleys back with a wink and a satisfied smile. I direct my growing impatience at Jessica.
"Can we get to the reason for your visit?"
"Okay, yeah, so Aiden Hughes was arrested for reckless driving, and it's his third offense."
Celebrities flexing their sense of entitlement is not uncommon in LA. No doubt he'll get off scot-free. I'm just not sure what this has to do with me. "Seems like a real winner," I murmur, as a growing sense of dread creeps up on me.
"As part of the plea deal, he needs to complete 300 hours of community service."
Can I get the cliff notes to this story?
"And 3 months of house arrest."
Heartbreaking. I'm weeping inside. What does this have to do with me? I can't help myself. My patience is running on empty, and my workday is only starting.
Biting her lips, she adds, "I sort of pitched this place."
After parsing the words carefully, it still sounds too far-fetched to be real.
"Pardon? When you say you pitched this place, do you mean planet Earth, Ojai in general, or this ranch?"
"This ranch, specifically the rescue."
"Have you ever been in a car crash? In the split second right before impact, everything slows down. You start to see and feel things like you're observing them from afar. Then it speeds up all at once, and your world explodes with confusion and pain. We are at that moment in the story."
"You told your boss that her criminally negligent client can come here? To this ranch?"
The wide, toothy smile that spreads across Jess's face feels like a personal attack.
He can complete house arrest and community service at the same time. And what better way to clean up his tainted image than by taking care of rescued animals?
Then, musing to herself, she says, "It's next level genius." She follows it up with a fist pump that scares the living daylights out of me. Jessica's unbridled ambition is a relentless beast needing to be constantly fed.
"Were you high when you did this?
There's a reason I moved out here, far away from the hustle and bustle of civilization, to work with animals. I don't do well around people anymore. I used to love being around people. A lot. Now, I don't love it. Most of all, men. Particularly men."
"And the judge agreed,"
she continues, not even a little discouraged by my horrified expression.
"Isn't that great?"
"The judicial system in this country is broken."
"No, it's not. This isn't a halfway house for overprivileged losers. Besides, Mona will never allow it."
"I'll allow it,"
Mona bursts out, a little too cheerfully, if you ask me.
"Mona, please stay out of this," I hiss.
"And miss out on all the fun?
I'd rather not."
Sashaying to the coffee pot, she pours some into a mug which reads, "In my defense, I was left unsupervised," which basically sums up the entirety of Mona's very colorful life.
"Boo,"
Jess pleads, pulling out the heavy guns, her pet name for me.
"It's my chance to show Cruella that I'm an indispensable asset to the agency. I'm tired of being a glorified assistant. I've paid my dues, damn it. I'm begging you."
"We'll help you," Mona adds brightly.
"Right, Blue?
Isn't that what girl power's about? Jessica needs us."
"Girl power?" I mutter. "Mona, do you have any idea what this means? There won't just be Hughes to watch over, very carefully, I should add, but probably an entourage as well. Our little sanctuary will be overrun with LA assholes."
"Oh, honey, you know I can handle those Hollywood types in my bra and panties with one arm tied behind my back."
I suck in a breath, picturing the very real possibility of this happening.
"Please tell me you don't mean that in the literal sense." "I haven't even told you about the perks yet,"
Jess says, interrupting the dark path my mind's traveling down, which ends with a certain movie star criminal requesting a restraining order against Mona.
"He's prepared to make a sizable donation to the rescue."
Between the merchandise I've been selling and my steady and loyal followers on Instagram and Facebook, who have bailed the rescue out of a number of animal-related catastrophes, medical and otherwise, we've been getting by.
Barely, but we've managed to stay in the black.
Are we always in need of funding? Sure. Of course. Rescues don't happen on a schedule, and saving lives is costly. The vet bills alone are enough to keep me up at night. What I am not willing to do, however, is compromise my mental health for a few extra bucks. No amount of money would tempt me.
"Then, think of it as part of your personal growth,"
the master negotiator, also known as my best friend, quips back.
"Like therapy, but you get paid for it."
A small whine comes from across the counter. My attention shifts to Mona, who takes a slow sip of her coffee, her groomed eyebrows steadily climbing up her forehead.
"I guess this is as good a time as any," she mutters.
"A good time for what?" I ask hesitantly, very hesitantly.
"To tell you that I'm a little behind on the property taxes.
If I don't have a heart attack today, nothing will ever kill me."
"How behind are you?" I force myself to ask, even though I really don't want to know the answer.
2 years.
2 years? How much?
I got a little confused with the past due dates, I hear her say under the rushing of blood in my ears. "Andy said we can negotiate."
Andy, her attorney, he's supposed to be managing her finances, which begs the question, what else has he screwed up?
The animals are all I can think about. What would happen to my animals who have already experienced the worst this world has to offer?
"How much, Mona?" For a moment, she looks so guilty that I feel bad pressing her.
"Give or take a few dollars. $47,000.
I glance at Jessica. Wisely, she's not gloating. She maintains an appropriately neutral expression
as she waits patiently for me to do the math, to come to my own conclusion. I clear my throat and swallow the bile rising up. On second thought, I'll get the contract ready.
Chapter 2.
Who did this? The top of the slow feeder sits in the corner of the small paddock, broken into two pieces. Trampled, it seems, by tiny hooves. It's a contraption that forces the animals to pull the hay through slats, which stops them from consuming their daily amount all at once. No binge eating allowed at Mother Goose Rescue. Many of my little and big friends are on a medical diet and need to be fed small meals to rehab from starvation or other health-related issues. My sidekick, Billy, sidles up to me for moral support, and I automatically rub his floppy ear in return. Running an animal rescue wasn't what I planned on doing with my life, and yet not a day goes by that I'm not grateful for it. I don't know where I'd be without these animals to care for. In a way, they saved me. After the assault, I was lost, suffering from PTSD or whatever you want to call it. Even though I did my best to deny it, mostly to myself, the trauma took a toll on every aspect of my life, none more directly than on my work. I was a paramedic once, and a good one at that. It wasn't merely a job I loved with all my heart. It was a calling. There was never a dull moment. It was full of adventure, and the best part was that I got to help people when they were most in need. In every way possible, it was a career tailor-made for me. Nothing beat the feeling of coming home at the end of the day, knowing I helped deliver a baby on the side of the 405 freeway, or that we stopped a distraught teen from jumping off an overpass, or that my team and I saved the career of a high school running back who caught a stray bullet in the leg. He eventually went on to be drafted first overall into the NFL. I made a tangible, immediate difference in people's lives and loved every minute of it. For years, I did my job without any regard for my personal safety. It never even crossed my mind. After the incident, however, it was all I could do to not think about it, which really messed with my head. The same confidence that had sent me running into the most crime-ridden parts of LA without hesitation had deserted me overnight, and I had no idea how to reclaim it. My mojo literally went missing in action. At first, I kept my head down and pushed through, pretended I hadn't lost my confidence, pretended I wasn't on the verge of a panic attack a few times a day when things got dicey, as they often did. Running toward dicey situations is a part of the job description, after all. Then, the worst thing that could have happened, happened. I had an episode right in the middle of treating a gunshot victim. While we were stabilizing him, people living in the neighborhood loitered around out of natural curiosity. Nothing out of the ordinary. I'd been in that same exact situation thousands of times. But that day was different. As more of them came out of their homes to see what was happening, congregating around the scene of the crime, my anxiety escalated. It paralyzed me. I locked up like a non-responding computer program. I couldn't move. I couldn't think. I couldn't help anyone, least of all myself. That was the day I became a liability to my team, and more importantly, to the victim. That's when I knew I couldn't do it anymore. My issues getting in the way of someone's personal welfare was where I drew the line. So I quit. No mojo, no job. Keep busy, they said. Don't think about it too much. Sitting around has never been my thing, so I figured a temporary job, one far away from the one I loved and lost, was the next logical step. This was LA. There were $6 lattes waiting to be served somewhere. Frankly, I was ready to do any job short of the one I was trained in. Then a Help Wanted ad caught my attention. Desperately seeking a live-in companion. Must love country living and animals. Medical training or experience preferred. Getting as far away as possible from LA felt right at the time, and country living was just what I needed. The animals were an added bonus. I'd always loved animals. Living in a two-bedroom apartment with a single parent that was mostly absent made owning any impossible. I drove out to Ojai for the interview, met her three rescue horses, and a few days later, I moved into her guest house. That's how I met Mona.
She taught me everything she knew about caring for large animals since she'd been doing it all her life. And together, we started Mother Goose Rescue.
Well, which one of you scoundrels broke the top of this?
I tapped the plastic top of the feeder with the tip of my red cowboy boot.
Two mini donkeys and three mini horses innocently stare back at me, mouths full of hay, chewing slowly.
Hazel avoids eye contact, a dead giveaway that she's the guilty party. Hazel's our youngest mini donkey, a teenager. She's been going through a rebellious phase recently. Pepper, our senior rescue, is more cautious and respectful. We make allowances for Hazel's behavior because she was an orphan and not in the best of health when she came to live with us. But it may be time for some tough love.
Hazel?
Her response is to scratch behind her floppy ear with her back hoof. It's as close to an admission as I'm going to get. Grabbing the electrical tape off my tool belt, I make quick work of fixing the feeder. Fixing things is a large percentage of the work around here. I wake up at dawn, start feeding grain to those who need it, turn out the ones that sleep in the stable at night, fill the hay nets, clean the stalls, check the perimeter for anything broken, fix things, fix more things, administer meds, and with a number of our rescues being elderly and infirm, that means a lot of meds, rinse and repeat. All of this, and it's still only the tip of the iceberg. A million things can go wrong on a farm, and they usually do.
So look, there's going to be lots of new people running around here tomorrow. I don't want you to be scared.
I checked out Aiden Hughes' Instagram account last night, and let's just say the only way to survive the next few months with my mental health intact is with a solid strategy. However talented he may be, and he is, the man is a complete attention-seeking narcissist. As a matter of self-preservation, I've determined I can play it one of two ways. Harpy man-hater or non-confrontational wallflower. Both strategies have merit, but the wallflower requires less energy, and the harpy man-hater inherently carries more risk. Plus, it's more emotionally taxing, and I don't do emotional these days. Being confrontational drains me. The point is, I need to keep a healthy amount of social distance from a person that will be living here for the next 3 months, and it's not going to be easy.
You guys feel free to do what you guys do.
I shovel some more hay into the feeder I taped together.
Fart, play fight, slobber. Just be yourselves, and if someone's shoes get ruined in the process, then so be it.
There's something innately therapeutic about talking to animals. For starters, they're great listeners. They don't ever judge, and their capacity to forgive brings tears to my eyes. Mona and I have seen cases of neglect and abuse so horrid, it makes you despair at the human race. And yet, those same animals have become loving and sweet when they're shown a little kindness, patience, and consistency. They never stopped wanting to trust. They never stopped giving humans the opportunity to not fail them. In the back pocket of my jeans, my phone rings. Cats in the Cradle by Harry Chapin plays. Talk about failure. I silence the call and wait to see if she leaves a message. As soon as it finishes recording, I hit the speaker button.
Hello, Miss Blue Baldwin. It's Athena Baldwin calling to see how you are. Did you try the caffeine enema I told you about? I sent you the link on your Gmail account.
I hear unintelligible voices in the background.
Damn it. They ran over the sump pump again. I gotta go. I'll call you when I get to Port-au-Prince. We really need to connect. There's something I need to discuss with you.
I immediately hit erase on the voicemail and stuff the phone back in my pocket.
Show me a parent who addresses their daughter by her full name, and I'll show you a parent who doesn't know their child.
My parents separated when I was 6. One random Saturday in August, my mother packed 2 suitcases and took off to the outer reaches of who the hell knows where in her attempt to save the world. She joined an NGO, and my father became a single parent overnight with no warning.
These are 2 people who should have never been married in the first place, let alone breed.
Athena is a flighty quitter masquerading as an activist, and my father is a cop as straight-laced and set in his ways as you can get. It's like a rabbit trying to mate with a turtle. Forget polar opposites, they're practically different species. Anyway, they never divorced. To this day, and for reasons no one can figure out, She still proudly brandishes the Baldwin family name, even though they haven't been in the same room more than 3 times in the last 22 years. Obviously, my mother and I are not close, but after the incident, she started calling more, which is just her style. Swooping in when there's a crisis and expecting credit for the most superficial of efforts is right on brand for her. Behaving as if she hasn't been missing in action for the last 20 plus years is a textbook Athena Baldwin move. My mother has always played the upper hand like a fiddle in a grand old Opry performance. It was hard to complain about her missing my 5th grade flute recital when she explained that she had to miss it because she was saving starving children in Sudan, especially when she then went ahead and showed me pictures of those children. I used to harbor a lot of resentment about this, and for the most part, I've let it go. She doesn't get to rock my world, in a bad way, because I won't allow her to have any power over me. That doesn't mean I'm rolling out the red carpet for her to waltz back into my life, only to ghost me when she gets bored. And saying no doesn't make me a bad person. The deep-throated rumble of tailpipes cuts into my musings. I scramble out of the paddock to investigate what the ruckus is about and hit the brakes the second I round the corner of the barn. The sound belongs to a vintage bike. Motorcycle, not Schwinn. The rider, a tall man with broad shoulders, gets off with his back to me, removes his black helmet, and runs his fingers through his thick, dark hair. A strange speeding sensation comes over me as I watch him take the aviator sunglasses hanging on his black t-shirt and put them on. It's Hughes. It has to be Hughes. He's got that snappy, overpriced look about him that seems to be standard issue for celebrities. Distressed jeans, distressed black t-shirt, distressed attitude, judging by a fleeting glance I get at his profile. But what's he doing here? He and his minions are supposed to arrive tomorrow, per the countless emails and phone calls I've received since we agreed on terms. I scan the horizon and can't locate anyone else. Regardless, it's go time. I can't hide, which frankly I do contemplate for a split second, and I can't have him wandering the property. So, taking a deep breath, I muster the will to put one foot in front of the other and meet this problem head on. This is where things get funky. And what I mean by funky is worse. Because the closer I get to him, the larger he becomes. And the larger he becomes, the more unsettled I start to feel. In my defense, this Aiden Hughes, the one in real life, is a lot more than the one on screen. Bigger, more rugged, more intense. Where's the dude who posted a video of himself getting a pedicure with black polish on Instagram? Because this is not it. Hi there, can I help you? I call out from a few feet away, my voice hitting a strange high note. Lord have mercy, I need to get a hold of myself with both hands. He's in the process of climbing the steps to the farmhouse and turns, finding me what feels like 1,000 miles below him. He looks older in person. Salt peppers his short, rich brown hair along his ears. Laugh lines are conspicuously absent, even though suntan lines crisscross his forehead.
Blue Baldwin,
he says, stepping back down. No proffered hand, no smile. We're dispensing with all the good stuff, I guess. The next 3 months are gonna be lit. I nod, my smile stiff.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?